All right, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Global Taiwan Institute. My name is Russell Hsiao. I am the executive director here at GTI. GTI is a 501c3 think tank dedicated to Taiwan policy research and related programs. Our mission is to enhance the U.S.-Taiwan relationship by contributing to a more informed public discussion about Taiwan here in the United States and around the world. In pursuit of that mission, we undertake several major programs. They include a biweekly publication called the Global Taiwan Brief, regular public seminars, annual symposium, as well as fellowship opportunities. We also organize cultural programs, and we actually have one coming up next Friday, which is a book talk with a Taiwanese-American novelist, Shauna Yang Ryan, who wrote a excellent novel, a historical fiction novel. I never get the genre correct, but it's called Green Island. So if you have time next Friday at 5 p.m., please make sure to sign up for that event as well. If you're not already subscribed to our to receive our updates, you may do so on our website at www.globaltaiwan.org. Now, before I begin today's program, I also want to take a moment to acknowledge the support of our co-founders, board of directors, our advisors, several of whom are in this room today. They include General Gregson, as well as Dr. David Tsai, and many friends of the Institute like Stephen Yates, whom I'm very pleased to see grace us with his presence here today. But also as well, I want to thank our staff members as well as interns, David Ahn, Marcia Bursai-Kelly, Jonathan Lin, as well as Ho Chen and Peter, our interns. Without them, all the programs that we undertake here would not be nearly as seamless as they appear. And so I want to thank them for their support. Last but not least, I also want to thank our sponsor of our Civil Society and Democracy series, the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy. The TFD is a National Democracy Assistance Foundation, the first one in Asia, and they engage in grant making as well as capacity building throughout the region and across the world in building linkages with other democracy activists, advocates, alike in promoting democracy and human rights around the world. And also one of our advisors, Thomas Hughes. Thank you for being here. So let's begin today's program. The title for today's program is Combating Fake News and Disinformation in Taiwan. At an international workshop held in Taipei just last week on defending democracy through media literacy, U.S. State Department Deputy Assistant Secretary Scott Busby stated, "Disinformation techniques seek to exploit the freedom and openness of democratic societies. In an evolving and increasingly fragmented news and information environment, disinformation causes individuals to question the accuracy of all news and information, even fact-based, reliable reporting from traditional news media. So, it is critical to support efforts to build resilience to disinformation in both the people and the institutions that support democracy." The workshop that the Secretary spoke at was held under the auspices of the Global Cooperation and Training Framework, GCTF, a platform co-organized by the American Institute in Taiwan and the Taipei Economic and Cultural Representative Office. Since 2015, the United States and Taiwan have worked together through GCTF in an ever-growing partnership that leverages Taiwan's strength and expertise and shares them with the rest of the world. There have been 13 workshops held on topics ranging from public health, energy efficiency, women empowerment, and law enforcement cooperation, all of which allow Taiwan to bring to bear its skills and assets in areas that benefit the international community. Media literacy, or more specifically, the means to combat disinformation and fake news, is an important case in point of such needed skills in this day and age. As noted by the de facto U.S. Ambassador to Taiwan, AIT Director Brent Christensen, in reference to disinformation, and I quote, "Taiwan is also on the front lines. And we all have much to learn from Taiwan about how to marshal our academic, policy, and technical resources to confront external pressure. America and other democracies' renewed focus on disinformation is taking place against the backdrop of the U.S. government's shift in focus to great power competition, and specifically contending with the rise of revisionist authoritarian powers, Russia and China, as clearly highlighted in the U.S. national security strategy. The challenges presented in the NSS extend beyond military domain and spans the demographic, economic, and political. In a testimony, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chief of Staff, General Joseph Dunsford, stated that when he considered demographic and economic variables, China probably poses the greatest threat to the United States beyond 2025. The rise of revisionist authoritarian powers is having an impact not only on the existing liberal international order, but also most relevant to our discussion today, the democratic systems. The CIA's Deputy Assistant Director for East Asia Mission Center, Michael Collins, stated at the Aspen Forum this year, "At the end of the day, the Chinese fundamentally seek to replace the United States as the leading power in the world. What they're waging against us is fundamentally a Cold War. They want every country around the world, when it's deciding its interests, its decisions on policy issues, to first and foremost side with China, not the United States." Indeed, the U.S. national security strategy explicitly stated, "Rival actors use propaganda and other means to try to discredit democracy. They advance anti-Western views and spread false information to create divisions among ourselves, our allies, and our partners." To be sure, disinformation is not a new tool. Disinformation has been used by the Soviets during the Cold War, and the Kremlin continues to utilize it today. And the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, has a long history of using disinformation against the KMT and also Taiwan. But democracies have somehow let their guards down after the Cold War. And as authoritarian countries continue to exploit the openness of the democratic system to their strategic gain. Strategically situated at the midpoint of the First Island Chain, Taiwan, a thriving Chinese-speaking democracy at the front line of China, has had to long contend with CCP propaganda and disinformation. This challenge has only grown more profound in the digital age with new media and social media. According to the private web company Statista, around 80% of Taiwan's population are active social media users, with Facebook as the most popular social media site at 77% penetration rate, and LINE as the most popular messaging application with 71%. I was told earlier today by my colleagues from Taiwan that is probably far, actually even greater than 71%. Only to say that it is significant, very significant. The challenge of disinformation was thrown into public view during the controversial pension reforms debate in Taiwan. Netizens and users of LINE began to see a flood of messages and websites that carried false claims about the central government's plan. Another recent example of disinformation also throws into sharp relief that this disease is not only a question of our values, but it could also have real life consequences, life and death consequences. Fake news were circulated about a Taiwanese envoy's alleged failure to assist Taiwanese tourists stranded at a Japanese airport during a typhoon in September, contributing to his suicide. The source of this fake news was reportedly traced to an IP address in Beijing and attributed to a Chinese government task force. Highlighting the challenge, President Tsai underscored this issue and committed her administration to tackling the sheer challenge of disinformation to democracies in her National Day speech on October 10th. And I quote, "For cases involving systematic dissemination of disinformation from specific countries, we will strengthen cross-border collaboration. That includes not only experience sharing, but also setting up monitoring and notification mechanism so that together we can respond to any damage or negative impact that disinformation has on social stability in various countries." It really stands as a strong testament to Taiwan to have the leader of Taiwan make disinformation such a central issue in her administration's approach. From disinformation related to potential switches to diplomatic relations, false claims that it may have led to people's deaths, tarnishing people's credibility, spreading rumors about controversial government policy to instigate protests or incite unrest, the fabrication of fake images, scaring the public, obscuring or falsifying statements, the utilization of 50-cent army, so-called 50-cent armies, proxy organizations, content farms, and flooding of online forums. These are all just some of the means that China is utilizing to spread propaganda and disinformation. This challenge is, of course, compounded by perpetrators through the exploitation of democratic politics and heightened sensitivities during the elections. There are many methods by which China is engaged in spreading disinformation, and combating this challenge is something that governments alone cannot do. It must include civil society. Indeed, more information sharing, public-private partnerships are critical for combating CCP malign influence by promoting greater information domain awareness among the public. Just as the NSS diagnosed the problem, it also proposed a solution. And I quote, "A democracy is only as resilient as its people. An informed and engaged citizenry is the fundamental requirement for a free and resilient nation. For generations, our society has protected free press, free speech, and free thought." Today, I'm very excited to be joined by experts who really understand the issues from both the technological as well as the policy perspectives. We'll be able to hear from people who can not only talk about the problem, but are actually doing something about the problem. To my immediate left, we have you have their bio, so I'm not going to go into too much details, but only to say that I'm very pleased that Johnson and Billion have joined us here today. They have co-founded COFAX, which is an online experimental platform in Taiwan that conducts collaborative fact-checking. This was started in mid-2016, and this is based on the LINE application that I was referring to earlier, that a very significant percentage of people in Taiwan utilize. To their left, we have Nick Monaco. Nick is a disinformation researcher and computational linguist. He's a research affiliated at the Oxford Internet Institute's Computational Propaganda Project and the Digital Intelligence Lab, a think tank that's located in Palo Alto, California. He also works as an intelligence analyst at Graphica, a network analysis company that tracks online disinformation campaigns. I've only met Nick recently, but I've known him, his name, much longer than that, actually. I'm a big fan of his, actually, when I read his work on computational propaganda in Taiwan, which was published a little over a year ago, I think.
June 2017.
And that was just one of the most original research I've seen on the subject matter, where he, you know, analyzed really the different types of bots that were being used, the different campaigns that were being utilized in Taiwan, and I'm very pleased that Nick is now in Washington, D.C., and so I can pick his brain as often as I possibly can, that he will allow me to do so. Last but not least, we have my good friend and former colleague, Rachel Burton. Rachel is the Deputy Director of the Project 2049 Institute, where she manages the Institute's research and program development. She currently conducts research and analysis on the Chinese Communist Party's foreign policy, U.S.-Taiwan relations, and U.S. policy towards Burma, Myanmar. And so what we have here today is a great group of experts. And since we have Johnson and Billion here, what I'd like to do is have Johnson and Billion kick us off taking us into the weeds about what they've done with COFAX, which is, a great platform and inspiring one. And then we'll move to Nick, who'll give us a talk on the computational propaganda, and then closing with Rachel giving us, you know, the bigger picture again of why this matters. So, Johnson, please.
Thank you, Russell, for
keep talking to the microphone.
Oh, yeah. And thank you, Russell, for the introduction, and thank you everyone for meeting us today here. So I'm going to talk about this COFAX, which is a crowdsourced fact-checking chatbot that we have been recently working on. And the link of the slide is on the top right corner. It's bit.ly/COFAX-GTI. So because we have some links inside the slide, so maybe you'll find this slide useful. Okay, great. So my name is Johnson, and my day job is a web developer at an internet company. But in my free time, I contribute to this open source software project, and which I dedicate most of my time to Kofax project, the open source civil tech project that I founded. Yeah. And Kofax is one of the many, many projects in GovZero community. And GovZero is a civil tech community in Taiwan connecting people of different backgrounds via bi-monthly hackathons. So let's back to our background. In Taiwan, the LINE messaging app is just dominant. About 90% of Taiwanese population, regardless of their age, regardless of how old they are using LINE within at least one time within a week. It is from a report that is published by LINE. And this scam appeared many, many times in one of these LINE chat rooms. And it comes with hundreds of varieties, and they just share one thing in common is that all of these messages will ask you to follow a certain account, and after you do that, you will get benefits like free stickers online, or free things, or free stuff, anything that's free. And people will say, "Oh, it's free," then you will just like share to everyone. This kind of message is actually fake, and it has been debunked by numerous of individual fact checkers in Taiwan. And every time there is a variant of such message, there's a debunked message, and there's just a lot of them. And actually, the public media has also have also published reports on it, and the LINE official also has published announcements against such message. They will tell the LINE users that beware of such messages. But well, this message is still spreading. So Kofax tried to tackle with this with a different approach. We tried to fight such information with chatbots. So here is how it works. Whenever a user receives a message and they are in doubt, they can just forward such message to our chatbot. And the chatbot, after receiving such message, it will answer with fact-checking reports that is stored from the database automatically. So here is how it works like. Let's see the loads. So it is a footage that is taken like this user just received a free sticker scan, and they just can forward it to the chatbot. And it looks up the database and automatically responds with a fact-checking report. And this user can, they found that, that is useful. Then they can just forward our fact-checking report back to where this misinformation appeared. So this is how Kofax would help spreading fact-checking reports. Basically, it is doing, it is spreading the fact-checking reports in the same way that misinformation does. So this is the some statistics of how Kofax is working now. There are like 46,000 of LINE users adding Kofax as their contact, so they can just forward a message to us. And we have received 20,000 messages for the last 30 days, and 70% of them are inside our database, so our LINE bot can automatically respond. So how do a chatbot know what to respond? It's actually the database do the magic. The database is comprised of the user submitted instant messages and the editor's reply. When the user sends us a message and the chatbot found that, hey, it's not in the database, the chatbot will ask the user if they want to submit a message. But before that, the chatbot will ask the user, hey, why do you think it is a hoax? What's their doubt in mind? So the user can just like type in what they think that the reason why they think it is a hoax into the chatbot, and this information as well as this article is as well as the message itself is useful for editors to plan the replies precisely. And by asking our user this question. It is also helpful to media literacy, we think, because it helps the user. It just helps the user to start trying to put their feelings of doubts into words and really start to think about, hey, why do I think this is a hoax? So I think it will help the media literacy. And with the user's reason and their clear consent in place, this message and their reason is submitted to and stored in this website, kofax.0.tw. It is where the editors will come and submit replies. An editor can take a look at the message on the website and choose from contains correct information or contains misinformation. They can fill in the fact-checking summary and their references, which those references often point to existing fact-checking reports or existing news reports. And what the editors have entered will be stored into a database, and the chatbot will use the reply in the future when the same message is forwarded to a chatbot again by someone else. So here's a quick review. There are two groups of people involved in Kofax. The users will read the reply and submit new messages through the chatbot to the database. And the editors would view the messages and submit replies through the website. Okay, so the system looks pretty straightforward, but who can be the editors? Actually, we allow everyone to become editors. Everyone, as long as they have Facebook or Twitter or GitHub account, can register at our website and start writing replies right away. There's no background checks and there's no verification steps. So, but if we don't have background checks on editors, how can we ensure the quality or how can we ensure the correctness? There's a research in 2005 has shown that Wikipedia is just as accurate, as correct as encyclopedias. I think that they achieved this by welcoming everyone to edit. So we believe that being open for everyone to, this will make sure that anyone that wants to improve the current reply can just not, they are not just blocked at a doorway, they can just log in and submit their new reply. And we also have other designs that would support this decision of allowing everyone to edit. For example, one design is that actually we allow multiple replies attached to one message. So that in this we can see that there are different replies stating one message is misinformation or another reply saying that, hey, it does contain some correct information, and they are all displayed at the same time. So we do this to embrace and appreciate the diversity of replies. And since the editors are just ordinary people, the editors will need to convince their readers about their replies. So we encourage our editors to put references. For instance, this is an actual response from our editors to a free sticker scam. So the editor just found three references from different sources to say that, hey, to convince the user that please stop spreading this free sticker scams. And also we do have a voting system from the line user, so the line user can vote whether this reply is useful or not, and the vote result will be helpful for other users to choose the reply to read, and they are also useful to the editors because the editor can look at the score and see that if they need to improve their reply. So since Kofax is open to anyone, there is one question left. What if we are under attack or we are flooded by malicious editors? And I have to admit that it is a very tough question. Since if our website is penetrated and it lost trust from the public, then people would never come back. So, therefore, our take to this question is to try to make our project easily replicated by others. So we open source all of our source codes, and we write documentation and workshops to teach people to run CodeFax, this system, on their laptop so that they can easily replicate the whole system. And as well as our data, the database is open as well, distributed to the public domain by CC0 license. So our data, our messages collected to now is totally available to anyone. And our meeting notes, our design decisions is also open. We collect all of them into what we call a CodeFax toolkit, which is in English, to help all the people that wants to build their own CodeFax to like start take information inside here and start their own CodeFax. So we would love to see that people replicate the whole CodeFax and add their own flavor or add their own measure to help to keep their system more resilient to the CodeFax, to malicious editors. And as well as, so for the CodeFax, we will stay as an experimental platform that opens everyone to edit. But we do allow others to replicate and do their protection. So even if CodeFax is down by, which is flooded, CodeFax is flooded by the others, then we hope that all these other variants can survive. And if not, hey, CodeFax is still open source, so anyone can pick up from where we have failed to start their own. So, since CodeFax collects message and reply in an automatic way, actually we have some interesting insights because it is automatic, so everything has a record. Then analytics information may be really interesting. So we also released it. As we also released our usage report openly in like codefax.gov0.tw/analytics. And it is connected to our Google Analytics under the hood. For each of these reports, you can specify the time range you want to inspect and choose the interested message you want to visualize. It is actually really hard to do this for closed messaging platforms. But with CodeFax, we can shed some light of what the information is spreading in those closed message platforms. One of the most useful insights would be the most popular or most asked message in a certain period of time. So this is like this is a ranking list from this analytics report of the most popular messages in last 30 days. So we can see that there are like a third of them is about free sticker scam. So yes, even though we have CodeFax, we still receive a lot of free sticker scams because people just can't stop sharing free stuff. There are a third of other portion of the message is about like fake public news. Like they will spread something like, hey, the pork from the meat from Japan is all radiated, so you cannot eat them. And they will just spread this kind of fear to the public. So there are also a lot of them. And for this analytics, there are another interesting aspect is to take a look at the timeline of these messages, because like those queries inside will record a timestamp of being asked. So for example, here are two popular hoaxes spreading in the closed messaging groups regarding the same-sex marriage. And when this kind of message is being asked in our database or the trend, we can see some correlations between this spreading phenomenon and the actual events. Like for example, we see the two peaks in terms of time. the first peak of this message being spread happens after our legislative committee has approved our amendment for same-sex marriage. And the second peak is also related to real-life events. Yeah, so COFAX is also have some analytics for others to see and for the researchers to take a look and to gain insight from our analytics report. So COFAX currently are faced with several challenges. The most prominent challenge would be scalability issue. In other words, there are just not enough active editors. For example, we actually are having like 30 to 40 new messages submitted into the database every day. But the daily active editors is about 3 or 4. So the editors are retiring. It is retired too for these few editors to handle such a large number of new messages. So what we are trying to do is to retain the editors. So we already held bi-monthly meetup for all the editors to come to a same place and do fact-checking together. This is for like social bonding and like help try to like influence the editors using some social proofing techniques. And we also prepare gifts to give away to the editors.
I just read the gifts.
Yeah. We try providing a game-like experience when submitting replies. So we also designed something like level system. So they can like when they submit replies on CodeFest, they can level up. Yeah. And we also try to motivate them by making their contribution visible to others. So like this is the actual post. We post weekly to our editors' Facebook group to thank all the editors that have submitted replies in the past few weeks, in the past week. Yeah. And the second challenge is about the delay, which is also well known in academic papers. And in academic papers, they say that by the time the article has been fact-checked, many users, they have already read the misinformation and much damage would have been done. And such limitation can be seen on CodeFacts as well. So for example, this is an opinion piece that contains some misleading information about Taiwan's government's new southbound policy. And the government actually do act quickly, but it took several days for our editors to pick up the response and actually submit to COFAX. So therefore, there are actually a lot of users. Only part of the line-by users can get the replies, and the others will just say that, hey, we already submit such message, but we don't have replies yet. Only the other users will receive such reply, and it's not really useful to them. So what we are trying to do to this is to tackle with this is to like to cooperate with local fact checkers. And so for example, we just like invite them to become CodeFacts editors. So when the local fact checkers come up with a new fact checking report, they can go to CodeFacts and put their write a reply and put their fact checking report to the replies reference. So that we basically encourage the fact checkers to use CodeFacts as a channel to spread their fact checking reports. So another thing that we are going to do is to automatically categorize the incoming misinformation into topics. So we can do it by like machine learning or building topic models using AI or something like that, some technical stuff like that. And If we can like automatically categorize these messages, then we can build a subscription list. So the editors that is interested in responding certain topic can subscribe to such messages, subscribe to such list. Then when a new message comes, they can just get notified and they can come up to Colfax more quickly. So I think that is another way which we haven't done, but we are currently trying to do to try to reduce delays between the Hawks and the Fast Tracking reports. Yeah, so I think that is the end of my presentation, and I'm going to give the presentation to Billion, and Billion, we are going to provide some case studies of actual messages that is spreading in Taiwan.
Hi everyone, and I'm going to... Hi everyone, I'm Billion. I'm going to share with you some cases what's happening in Taiwan and how COVID deal with it. My name is Billion. My daily job is a Mandarin teacher. And in my free time, I contribute to open source project. And most of my time, I dedicate at COFAX, the open source civil tech project with disinformation and misinformation in Taiwan. And last Sunday, there was the Puyuma Express train crash accident in Taiwan. Plenty of people injured, 18 people died, and Garbage Zero as a crowdsourcing community soon establishing a website to for reveal necessary information in time. Also called Nobody, that's why Garbage Zero Nobody, voluntarily make these data together and make the important resource to clear to public. Also, Colfax received some rumors from users, like go donate your blood now, and while the Blood Foundation said and they kept telling people that it's enough, and also that Taiwan Railway Administration claims the accident is because the driver turned off ATP, the automatic train protection. But Executive Yuan announced that the Railway Administration didn't tell the truth. The train crash happened at the same day, some message being forwarded to everybody. And at least three mass media noticed this situation. It said that Godfather is telling Taiwanese people, legalized gay marriage is violating God, and worse disaster will appear next time. To have a man marry a man, a lady marries a lady, newborn baby are less and less, and making grandparents like them, dying without any descendant. It's important to have discrimination expressed like this. It's impractical. While some religious people said, and God will punish you guys like this, it is ridiculous to say that global warming, earthquakes, drought, or even train crash happening are owing to marriage equality. The Constitutional Court and announced the judicial grant interpretation number 748. Taiwan will be the first country in Asia to legalize marriage equality. Regarding the constitutionality of same-sex, the relevant law should be amended or enacted within 2 years. However, it's really sad that there are still some conservative people disagreeing marriage equality in Taiwan. Now, there are half our referendum relate to marriage equality. In the past, Taiwanese people couldn't realize what the initiative and the referendum and the recall as instrument of democracy. That would be a very, very long time because all of the referendums were failed. But since the amendment last year, 2017, now people can decide and promote some policies by themselves finally. As a result, we face off rumors now. And these two referendums, they are all opposite. This is for the conservative people and it's for the marriage equality supporter. Hundreds of suspicious messages sent to COVID database. Like this. I need to solve several rumors like this every day. And gender equality education act claims that children don't need to feel guilty while they feel they're different. It's the most popular referendum-related rumor this week, that there are some rumors that COVID received for years since that when we have COVID in 2016, before the constitution interpretation. I have no idea about this. Will you get married with Taiwanese people just one for the national health insurance? I don't think so. So, so lots of medical help by developed country already have, and AIDS is under control. The disease doesn't drag national health insurance down. Also, that sexual revolution doesn't mean to be fornication or a sexual promiscuity. Well, it's a little bit tricky with the term in Mandarin. We understand in English that it's emancipation, but in Mandarin, it's more like indulgence than sexual revolution. And sexual revolution is respective and equal. And lots of rumors say that if we teach kids about homosexual, the pure children, and they may be confused, changing gender identity and turn into LGBT people. Homosexual education means to know more about diversity without discrimination and bullying, having more understanding with a friendly environment to protect any kind of student positively. And it's the last month before the election and the referendum. In the case, and there are more than 100 counts view the reply. The user could easily forward this reply to another chat room and having friend read this reply as well. And since homophobia is still common in daily life, user forwarding their thoughts then getting reply automatically with chatbot. We make it faster and easier. We hope COFAX could do something for media literacy. I believe we could do have a more equal society. I love my country and I wish Taiwan could be the real first one who respects value of human rights in Asia. We could like ourselves. We don't have to come out of the closet, but we don't deserve it. We're just luckier. So vote for our future, and we are heterosexual, and we support marriage equality. Thank you for your listening.
Well, thank you both, Johnson and Villian, for that. Taking us through COFAX, how you develop it, how it works, and the different cases that you've identified. You know, I think before handing it over to Nick, quickly, I would just say that, you know, I think there's a, what you've, Johnson, I hear you repeatedly say misinformation, and I think it's important for us to distinguish, of course, misinformation and disinformation. And I would just point out that, you know, that there is a thin line between misinformation and disinformation, and the question goes into intent. I think that's where, you know, I think national security analysts and those who are in the business of trying to identify the intent as well as the perpetrators will need to work, you know, with the, there needs to be a private and public partnership in trying to both be able to have enough information in terms of what are the information out there, and then trying to pair that up with, you know, what the intent may be. And secondly, I would just say that, you know, I think in a lot of the means, in terms of the free sticker scam, you know, that is being spread, it's the same type of means that could be used to spread different types of other types of information, right? I mean, I think what you've identified as sort of how to socialize, you know, these types of different, or social engineer, these types of misinformation campaign, word disinformation campaign, goes. There's a lot of social engineering involved with this. People love their free things. What other stuff do they like to, you know, share freely? I think those are elements that we can, you know, think about as we as we think about why and how this type of activities happen. And fourth, you know, I think it's, you know, your efforts about, third, about your efforts to try to reduce the delays. I mean, that's absolutely essential. I think it's so important that we get fast, reliable, and precise attribution. And the more that you can sort of, and that's why civil society is so important, I think, in this broader effort to combat, you know, fake news and disinformation, because there just needs to be, you know, greater, you know, awareness. About this, and that you know, so that we can reduce that type of negative externality that results from, again, the fake news being out there for a period of time. So, Nick, why don't you move it over to you?
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here with a great panel. Thanks to Russell for inviting me out and the Global Taiwan Institute. Basically, I'm just going to talk a little bit about computational propaganda today. And a paper that I did on Taiwan about a year ago, examining political bots and computational propaganda within the context of Taiwan specifically. So I've been studying computational propaganda for about 3 years now. I started in 2015, and this was a time when normal people, even experts, a lot of them didn't really know the term political bots. They hadn't heard the words computational propaganda, disinformation, or maybe even fake news before. I mean, it was a different time. After the 2016 presidential election here, and I think after Brexit, the West in particular started paying a lot more attention to these problems, although they've been happening worldwide in a number of different contexts for a lot longer than that. And I think also in Asia, people have started paying more attention after the 2016 presidential election. So it's fun to watch public awareness and civil society awareness and even layman literacy of the problem kind of increase as time goes on. I do feel like some important strides have been made in the past year, and we're definitely not in the same situation we were just 3 years ago. So just to put that in context. So I lived in Taiwan for a year and a half. Taiwan's pretty near and dear to my heart. I had studied political bots and computational propaganda before doing my paper on Taiwan, but I was very curious to look at Taiwan in particular and see if some of the problems that I'd seen with political bots and disinformation were occurring within a Taiwanese context. I think Taiwan is very crucial right now geopolitically. To observe for a number of reasons. I don't think at this point that it's a controversial claim to say that there's somewhat of a worldwide battle going on right now between autocratic governance and democratic governance. And that's happening at both a domestic and a transnational level. I think Taiwan is kind of a bellwether for what's going on worldwide. And part of that context, as Richard, you highlighted, is that Taiwan, of course, lives very close to mainland China. Taiwan's always been important for that reason geopolitically to observe. I think right now it's even more interesting and even more crucial given the context of technology. Technology is really at the center of geopolitics in a way that I don't think it has been before. And I think that Taiwan and China really embody two different visions of how technology can be used to realize what would be the ideal society of the rulers or the people. On one hand, you have Taiwan, which I think is one of the most progressive societies and cutting-edge societies in terms of using open data and using civic technology to embody democratic and liberal values and empower people and really lower the bar for political participation and for participating in democratic governance. And I was fortunate enough to meet Billion and Johnson in person in June when I went to the East Asia Democracy Forum and a disinformation workshop. And one of the things I saw on the ground is just that the civic tech movement in Taiwan is really strong right now. And I think that's something that's very unique to Taiwan and isn't really existing elsewhere in the world. Of course, it is to varying extents, but the extent to which it's alive and thriving in Taiwan, I think, is something that's worth highlighting. And GovZero, of course, is at the center of that, the Open Culture Foundation, the COFAX project. So I'm excited to be here today, and I just really want to highlight that. China, on the other hand, of course, is careening towards digital dictatorship, if it hasn't already passed that line long, long ago. And you can witness this in any number of things going on domestically, whether it's facial recognition software being used to arrest people at the Qingdao Beer Festival or many incidents after that. A lot of things going on in Xinjiang right now. I mean, there's a lot of really concerning developments going on in China that do have worldwide implications, whether people are paying attention or not. So I think that this contrast between these two societies is really crucial to observe and to analyze and see what we can learn from it in a global context. With that in mind, I wanted to talk a little bit about the paper itself that I did on Taiwan about a year ago through the Oxford Internet Institute and the Computational Propaganda Project, and just talk about some of the main highlights. If you're curious, you can, of course, read it online. It's free, but I kind of wanted to talk about what I thought was interesting and unique to Taiwan. Political bots, I don't know how many people in the audience, probably most of you at this point, are familiar with them, but essentially they are computer programs that control profiles online. So most often these are programs that are posing as humans online. They might not always be using AI to converse with people, but that's one thing that they can do. But political bots in particular are deployed to, of course, effect a political goal. So manipulation of public opinion, persuasion of the public is really the goal here. And they can all do all kinds of things, from interacting with humans to liking content or retweeting content, and they exist on a number of different platforms. One of the challenges in Taiwan, in comparison with a lot of countries in the West, is that the social media landscape is quite different. Facebook is the main platform by far in terms of web browsing, social media activity. And then, of course, as we've gathered from Russell's introduction, and the COFAX presentation, LINE is, of course, extremely important to the problem of disinformation in Taiwan. As open source researchers, Twitter is a useful entity to study and observe, because we have been doing it for about a decade now, and we have a lot of tools that can tell us this account has, you know, 87% probability of being a bot, this article has this much engagement, and it's much more difficult to figure those things out on Facebook, and especially online on encrypted messaging apps. So that's one challenge that goes into checking things out in Taiwan. Within the paper, we looked at Facebook, of course, to try to figure out what was going on, and we used a mixed methods approach. So we looked at both quantitatively what was going on, and we interviewed some people on the ground, including Johnson, to kind of get a feel for you know, what the human and social context was. On Facebook, I was interested in seeing, you know, are political bots being used in a way I've seen before around the world to amplify messages, to spread disinformation? And for the most part, the answer was no in Taiwan. So there are two contexts we're working with here, a domestic one and an international one, which I'll come to in a bit. But domestically, we kind of explored the 2014 mayoral election, specifically in Taipei, so between Ke Wen-je and Shang Lian. And we found really interesting things on both sides. In Shang Lian's case, there was an academic paper that sort of explored the fact that there were certain IP addresses on PTT, which is very important as well in Taiwan, basically a Taiwanese version of Reddit, a messaging board. So there were certain IP addresses that were promoting Shang Lian and, I guess, denigrating or being against his opponent, Ke Wen-je. And this was interesting because it was a form of organized messaging and coordinated messaging. Of course, there's no way of knowing whether this was paid for, whether it was just convicted citizens who wanted to promote the candidate they liked. It was interesting nonetheless, and it's a form of manual coordination. On Ke Wen-je's end, we found that the company that he used, or at least one of them, to engage in digital electioneering and promoting himself, was using bots not for the purpose of promoting themselves or sending out messages, but really for the purpose of intelligence gathering. So there was basically bots, computer programs that were crawling Facebook and gathering data on users, what they liked, what they didn't like, and they were using this in real time to inform the campaign, to inform how Ke Wen-je, how his views or his public statements were being received, if he made any political gaffes, you know, how much did that really affect his campaign. And this was an interesting kind of shift in perceiving the problem for me, because I'd always thought about bots as being active, and promoting messages. And really in Taiwan, this is a case of intelligence gathering. I have a suspicion that this is why there are so many Chinese language and particularly simplified Chinese language egg profiles on Twitter. You can set up a fake account and then deploy a bot through that account to gather intelligence. But that's not confirmed, that's just a suspicion. And then coming to the transnational context within the paper, basically we found what appeared to be Chinese mainland citizens who were engaging in coordinated messaging on Tsai Ing-wen's Facebook page after she won the presidential election in 2016. And basically this was a case of organized coordinated messaging, again, that appeared to be coming from citizens. And there did not appear to be any bots involved. One of the key things that was interesting in my interviews, I talked to a journalist who said, well, China really may not have a need of using bots en masse to promote a message. At least in the case of Taiwan, mainland Chinese citizens are fairly uniform in their view that Taiwan is part of China. And not only that, but they're happy to go to bat for it. They're happy to talk about it, and they're happy to be as loud as they want about it. So if you can just mobilize that base, thinking from, you know, the eyes of the Chinese Communist Party, and get them to jump over the wall and start messaging about it, that's really all you have to do. So that was an interesting way of thinking about the problem of leveraging something and kind of putting distance between actually carrying it out in a direct way. I think the last bit of context I'd like to add, just to not go over time, is that these interesting computational propaganda or digital electioneering, however you want to phrase it, incidents that we found domestically in Taiwan were happening in the case of a mayoral election. My colleague, Dan Arnato, who works at the National Democratic Institute, found that similar stuff was going on in Brazil at the same time. And he highlighted in his paper that was released within the same set of papers that basically mayoral elections can be sort of an experimental ground for testing out techniques that are then deployed at scale nationally. And I say this, of course, setting the ground and thinking about the fact that we have mayoral elections coming up in November in Taiwan. We have several important referenda. News broke a few days ago that China has been trying to influence media channels in Taiwan pretty heavily to promote the candidates that they favor. So I think it's good to keep an eye out right now, and I think we can expect to see some interesting things going on around the local elections this upcoming month, or next month, rather. Thank you.
That's great, Nick. Thanks. Rachel?
Thank you all. Russell, GTI, thank you for having me today, and everyone for coming out on a Friday afternoon. So I was asked to discuss the CCP's influence operations or sharp power against Taiwan and assess how the use of propaganda and disinformation fits into Beijing's overall domestic foreign policy goals and interests. And just to get it out of the way, to me, I think Beijing's greatest disinformation campaign is the fact of that they always say the greatest information, let me take a step back, the greatest disinformation campaign is the One China Principle. And that's really, I think, what we're all here to talk about. When we talk about disinformation, when we talk about misinformation, we're talking about computational propaganda tools. The ultimate goal of all of this is to create the effect and the erasure of Taiwan, the erasure of the Republic of China. And the point of that is to promote Beijing's stance of the One China Principle globally. Before I get into the rest of my comments, I want to kind of acknowledge the great work already done by Mark Stokes, Amory Brady, Russell, Peter Mattis, John Garneau, J. Michael Cole, the USCC, and others that really informed my own research, but has also informed my understanding of this topic. And a lot of the issues that I touch in this, in my next few comments, they have done a lot of great work on. So for me, I'm going to explore really the theme of the CCP's quest for legitimacy, so the Chinese Communist Party's quest for legitimacy, and the links to the global comparison and the erasure of the existence of Taiwan through its narrative of the One China Principle. So while there's a lot of scholarship, news articles, and public events that explore the tactics and the front organizations utilized by the Chinese Communist Party to conduct influence operations or to conduct sharp power, I want to revisit why the CCP engages in this Marxist-Leninist form of interference and why it's important. So to take us back, I want to go to 1949 and the birth of the People's Republic of China. And since 1949, the CCP has maneuvered all sources of state power to include economic, education, military, civil society, media, and politics to adopt a successor state mentality that the Republic of China perends Taiwan and the government seated in Taipei ceases to exist. This, of course, is not the reality. From Beijing's viewpoint, the ruling legitimacy of the CCP over Taiwan is inherently threatened as Taiwan, under its current Republic of China constitution, exists as a sovereign state with an elected president and an elected legislature empowered by the will of Taiwan citizens. To go back to a point that Billion has mentioned and Russell himself, the resilience of the people, the will of the people of Taiwan is important. So, therefore, the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party and the regime's maintained rule is the driving force behind China's sharp power. So, under General Secretary Xi Jinping, under his leadership, the very definition and scope of national security, and thus the security and the legitimacy of the CCP, has actually been redefined and broadened. The 2015 National Security Law has defined national security as a status in which the regime, sovereignty, unity, territorial integrity, welfare of the people, and other major interests of the state are not faced with any danger and not threatened internally or externally. And it emphasizes the regime's capability to maintain a sustained security status. Furthermore, all national security work will adhere to the leadership of the CCP. And all citizens, state authorities, armed forces, political parties, people's groups, enterprises, public institutions, and other social organizations shall have the responsibility and obligation to maintain national security. And again, so that means that people's groups, enterprises, public institutions, social organizations have the obligation to maintain the security of the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party. This is inherently what the 2015 National Security Law states. So ultimately, what the law does is it codifies the linkage of national security as a state, national security, to the security of the Chinese Communist Party as a political regime, and therefore sets the legal foundation for Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party to enforce its renewed stability maintenance regime, a Weiwen regime. And we see this played out in increased surveillance monitoring that my fellow panelists here have mentioned. We see it in the re-education and internment camps against Uyghurs in Xinjiang. We see it on the crackdown on Chinese human rights lawyers back in 2015. We see it in the anti-corruption campaign, the erasure of Taiwan in the international community and the shrinkage of Taiwan's international space, as well as the mobilization of the United Frontwork Department and the CCP's overseas Chinese affairs work. And the CCP's Overseas Chinese Affairs Department has actually now been moved and is underneath the leadership of the United Frontwork Department. So all of this reinforces and are connected to this idea of the security of the regime, and that's really the ultimate driving force of why disinformation is occurring. So during the 2018 two sessions meeting, General Secretary Xi Jinping offered important instructions to party committees, governments, and overseas Chinese Affairs Department at all levels, so national, provincial, village, township, to fully implement the party's overseas Chinese affairs policy. And the reason why this is important is because Chinese overseas affairs policy is really the type of influence operations work that we see here in the United States or in Australia, Canada, New Zealand. So there are four major components to this. The first is to safeguard the rights and interests of overseas Chinese and returned overseas Chinese and their relatives. The second is to promote the national modernization. The third is to promote peaceful reunification of the motherland. And the fourth is to promote friendly cooperation between China and foreign countries. It's also important to note that how the CCP defines overseas Chinese, it includes not just citizens of the PRC, but also citizens of other countries who are ethnically Chinese, and that also includes those from Taiwan. So me, a U.S. citizen, with Chinese or Taiwanese ethnic background, I count as an overseas Chinese, which is troublesome to me. how does the CCP utilize these overseas Chinese affairs groups to again export the idea of one China principle? So there are overseas branches called the China Council for the Promotion of National Reunification, which is an United Frontwork affiliate organization We're really the foot soldiers of China's sharp power. Like, we see them here in the United States. An example would be a branch in the United States called the U.S. West Coast China Council for the Promotion of Peaceful Reunification, where the chairman, who resides in Northern California, offered the following praise after the two sessions, where he said, overseas ethnic Chinese will firmly support the Chinese government's policy towards Taiwan on the basis of the One China Principle and the 1992 consensus, which I assume is how Beijing interprets it. The overseas Chinese groups will work hard to promote the peaceful development of cross-strait relations and promote the peaceful reunification of China and Taiwan. And so this group was actually fundamental in Northern California in organizing overseas Chinese communities in California to protest President Tsai's transits in Los Angeles. The CCP is inherently using forms of perception management to create narrative dominance through co-option, corruption, censorship, and disinformation that targets political and economic elites, the media, civil society, and academia to shape the international community's policies and perceptions of Taiwan in order to support Beijing's domestic and foreign policy objectives. So if Beijing is successful in erasing the very real existence of Taiwan or the Republic of China and erasing the political evolution of Taiwan's democracy, this will ultimately help Beijing's fundamental goal of solidifying the Chinese Communist Party's legitimacy and rule as not just a domestic power, but an international power. So at the end of the day, what does this mean for Taiwan? The CCP uses disinformation to sow confusion and distrust in open societies, as we've laid out, and perhaps an effort to shape public opinion in Taiwan to induce a political negotiation for reunification based on Beijing's terms. That's just not a hypothesis. A way for the United States and other governments to counter CCP's influence operations or this One China Principle narrative against Taiwan is to really just the simple acknowledgement and support of the existence of Taiwan, Taiwan's citizens, Taiwan's government, and the legitimacy of that government can go a long way. So things like FMS, arms sales with Taiwan, the Taiwan Relations Act, opening a new AIT, some would say that these are all merely symbolic, but there's great substance in the symbolism of recognizing the very existence that Taiwan has and is. Moving forward, I kind of raise three questions that merit answers to me when it comes to talking about CCP disinformation and what it means for Taiwan, and I urge others in this audience to perhaps research these topics. I think be really great help to the community. I see Nathan here from RAND, so if you want to tackle this one. But I think one question I have is, I think we should identify who at the bureau level, so the CCP, who at the bureau level coordinates the CCP's disinformation campaign against Taiwan? So how is it coordinated between the PLA Political Work Department, the PLA Strategic Support Force 311 base, and the Taiwan Affairs leading small group? So how is it all coordinated? Because these messages then, there are nodes that are coming out of China, are probably coming out of like submarine cable lines that are being controlled by an SSF, a Strategic Support Force unit, or someone from the PLA. I don't really think that the CCP is allowing just random bits of internet workings just go out without there being some level of coordination. So that's the first one. The second one is to identify indication and warning of possible military action. So I mean, how should Taiwan and perhaps the U.S. look at social media and disinformation as possible indicators and warning? What themes of the internet chatter might change, or what might be dialed up, what might be dialed down, and how can Taiwan and the United States use social media and this disinformation to look at indicators and warning? And the third is, what is the doctrine, what's the theory that guides the CCP's disinformation campaign? We've talked a bit about socialization. We can talk about type of like social psychology. So who on the CCP side is perhaps the brainchild behind how can we shape perception abroad? So those are kind of some of the thoughts that I have on this issue, and I kind of open the floor to questions and to Russell to take it over, and thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Rachel, and I really appreciate the the shout out there. It's always nice to have your work sort of appreciated there. But you've done a great amount of monitoring of this of these issues in your own right. And it struck me when you were when you were highlighting the why China's engaged in propaganda and disinformation against Taiwan. And it just there's a strong reminder here that the existence of Taiwan's democracy itself represents as an existential threat to the Chinese Communist Party, because it provides an alternative model. And so it's as China tries to undermine Taiwan's democracy, it's trying to legitimize itself, right? It's trying to legitimize its own authoritarian rule. And the more that Taiwan can strengthen its democracy, the more resilient it becomes. I think that becomes a bulwark to that type of authoritarian influence, and so that's important. Secondly, it's also, I think you've adopted in your time at Project 2049, as I have, the sort of the Mark Stokes approach to analysis, and that is looking at systems, right, and looking at systems and how they interact with one another, and that it's so important here as we talk about propaganda and disinformation, we don't think of it in isolation. That this is also part of a broader system and interacts with other systems, like the United Front system. Because at the end of the day, as we talk about the technology, which is important, which does sort of provide an exponential sort of effect on disinformation. Essentially, at the end of the day, the most prevalent vehicle of that is human, the human element of a propaganda and disinformation. The United Front is at the center of that. There's increasingly more attention paid to the United Front, and I encourage people to look at more studies about the United Front and how that interacts with broader sort of strategies. And so, because at the end of the day, this is really not only a whole of government approach by the CCP, it's a whole of society. At the end of the day, if we look at United Front as means to sort of mobilize, indoctrinate, and non-CCP masses, it touches not only overseas Han Chinese, but it's elite capture too as well. We can become unwittingly or wittingly agents of that if we're not aware of the type of campaigns that that the CCP is engaged in. I have some questions of my own, but we have such great sort of expertise in the crowd too, so I'd like to open this up and for Q&A from the audience. So if you can just raise your hand, state your name as well as your affiliation, and then please direct your questions or maybe a brief comment as well. Nathan over there.
Thank you. Nathan Bouchon, thanks for the great presentation. Really exciting to see what Taiwan is doing to safeguard itself against Chinese disinformation. I had a question for Johnson and Billion. It seems that you are perhaps agnostic between. Researchers like most of us in this room. And so I was wondering, you could talk a little bit about how you see that and if there's a value for your open source approach. So for example, can you track the IP addresses of who is raising the questions and who is responding to the questions? And it would seem to me that the lack of a certification or vetting for the responders also opens up for very easy for Chinese disinformation. If they start and so I was wondering if you, Chinese efforts, or whether you can tell if it's just, Taiwanese policing Taiwanese. That's.
Okay. So regarding the question of how to how can if we can. Sources or which we can attach download it is from China or not, and actually we can't, because that it is a technical issue, Since the message is forwarded inside closed chat rooms, there is no way that we can backtrack all the way back to a source of information. So basically what Kofax does is to, no matter what the sources are, we just take a look at the content of the message and find out the parts where the people will find that is questioning, or find out the fears that drives the user to spread such message and try to diffuse those fears. So it's not I'm not talking about that finding a source is not important. No, I'm not talking about that. But what we are trying to say is we can when we are doing this project, all we can do is to take a look at the content. And actually, I think it is also as important as tracking the source, because that people won't stop spreading the message after you just like, hey, it's from China, you cannot spread it. No, people will not stop sharing that after you just state that it's from China. People will still share the set. So I think that it is more important for us, since we cannot track the source, we are just to take a look at that source and diffuse what is really a point that drives the people to share. So, and in terms of tracking the source, I think that it is something that we cannot do, but we are willing to open our database. So, we are just like welcoming all the researchers that to come to our database to analyze the text. We cannot get IP addresses. This line doesn't give us. But you can take a look at the content and do the research on the content to find the China's influence inside all this content. It is something that we cannot do because we are busy replying all these messages. So if you take a look at this misinformation battle as a war, we are like privates working at the front lines. And so we cannot get the whole picture, but we leave all this information in our database. It is all what we have seen. So just please, everyone can just like come to collect this information and tell us that what is the intent behind. It is not something that we cannot find. We can just tackle with the content, but we leave all this information in our database and it is open source. Yeah.
Leo?
Hi, Leo Boschner, a disaster researcher, retired FEMA guy. I've got a question for Jonathan and Billion. It looks like a great project. You mentioned how tight it is trying to get these editors in there, small numbers. Have you considered broadening this in the future, possibly approaching the Taiwan government, universities, and news media? Ask them if they would assign people. Ask people, you know, spend an hour a week being editors for these people. I know when I was at FEMA, one of the things they did there was FEMA staff were monitoring the news media during disasters. And when the fake rumors would come up, within minutes, somebody would be on there saying, no, wait a second, here's the actual truth. I mean, you guys have a great system, you just don't have enough people, I think.
Yes, we do consider working with the educational institutes, like because like in universities and graduate schools, when they train the reporters, they will like have a training of like finding the controversial parts of the information and dig into it. And I think that it is a great source of educational purpose. Like we can just throw this database to them and tell these future reporters, future journalists to like bring this information down into pieces and provide useful replies, which will become a good source of reports in the future, they write. So I think that the educational part is very good. It is something that we can put some effort to it. But we currently did not go that because it will take some time for us to develop a kind of like a training program for a teaching, a project teaching program to develop a fusion program so we can teach to all these teachers. We haven't had the time to develop that. So we are trying to do that to loop in more editors like students. We can pay we can just pay them credits to come to do this editing source. And for the government side, I think that for the governments, we are invited to give speech to the national police agency. Yeah, because they are in charge of doing online scams, like 165 online scams and those parts. So what we are doing to them is the same we do to local fact checkers. Yeah, because we all know that we cannot get too close to the government because things like there are always some we'll need to as citizens we'll need to preserve some distance between the government or because we cannot control whether the next government will be like. Yeah, and so what we are doing is just to invite the government officers to come to COFAX as an editor so that when a government publishes an announcement, the government officer can act as a COFAX editor to proactively submit replies. And those replies will become one of all other replies inside COFAX database. So I think that is a sort of way to have the government's force, but don't always hear the government force. Yeah, it's a balance between this. Yeah. It's our comment.
Because we try to that, don't rely on the power of government. And since that, if we rely on government, the government said that, would you please do me a favor, that we're afraid that maybe government will prevent from that any news that doesn't have the right or have good for each our government. So we often try to prevent for that. And also that we invite a university student, we do, and another maybe doctors, journalists, a lot of different kind of background, their jobs, they all share together. That's what we do. That's for civil society. And as for the China rumors, well, because with a similar language, a lot of Taiwanese people that recognize simplified Chinese, and so also they do that with lines and WeChat. So a lot of that Chinese rumors will forward into Taiwanese platform. So we would get a lot of maybe the President Tsai Ing-wen or the National Palace Museum. So we just collect all the content and reply all of them, and we try our best to solve this problem with that rumors from China.
Hi, I'm Garrett Van Ries. I'm advisor to GTI, and I also teach history of Taiwan at George Mason University. I have a question for Rachel. Foreign Minister Joseph Wu recently said in an interview that all these disinformation campaigns from China are actually a good opportunity for Taiwan to build an informed electorate. Ideally, you actually wouldn't need all these bots and stuff like that. You have people who decide for themselves on an informed basis, this is garbage and this is good information. So how could Taiwan move in that direction? What would be a good approach for that? So it's education, of course, but what other things could be done in your view?
I think fundamentally what you're talking about is civil discourse. And that's important, being able to have disagreements and engagements with people on both sides of the aisle. I think especially in Taiwan, DPP, KMT folks, young generation, old generation, and how in Taiwan can universities or civil society create the environment where good civil discourse can occur about these issues and about these topics. And I think, and I would defer to you about the history of Taiwan, but I wonder what types of discussions were going on in Taiwan between the generations back in the 80s, right after martial law ended, versus after the third Taiwan Strait crisis, versus in 2016 after the Shima meeting. And I think that would be an interesting analysis about what type of discourse is going on in Taiwan. But further than what's going on the island, I think that type of discourse should occur here in the United States as well. I think there is a fundamental lack of awareness in the United States about the strategic importance of Taiwan. There's a different relationship that I think those of my generation and our general views of Taiwan is that it's difficult to relate to, because, you know, maybe we know a lot about the Middle East, we know a lot about terrorism. We're in this like post 9/11 world. We're dealing with our own, like the United States is dealing with our own political discourse and own societal issues here in the United States. But for the older generation, especially of World War II, they know a lot about Taiwan. Taiwan existed. Republic of China existed. Our military was, then it was Formosa, but our military was thinking about potentially, you know, invading Formosa in the Asia theater of World War II, and then obviously decided that was a bad idea because it's really difficult to do an amphibious invasion of Taiwan and of an island. So I think there's better understanding of Taiwan's strategic awareness from a generational gap in the United States between World War II generation and then perhaps those of my age.
I would just quickly add that, you know, I think Taiwan is already undertaking some longer-term initiatives to try to enhance media literacy. So, for instance, they are integrating media literacy into the K-1, K-12, you know, and into the education system, which is a great long-term effort, you know, to try to deal with this. But I think there has to be more immediate, more near-term and mid-term, you know, strategies to deal. And so, you know, again, I think this public-private partnership, you know, with civil society is so important because, you know, it's, you know, sort of in many ways, civil society is like the censors, you know, to a lot of the misinformation that could be disinformation, and that type of again, domain awareness is essential to trying to enhance the type of resiliency that is necessary to deal with this problem.
And Russell, to your point, I think trust is important in that resiliency. So the people's trust in the government, the people's trust in civil society groups, that social trust needs to be maintained.
So my name is Kathy Tai from Center for International for Private Enterprise. So SIPE is also monitoring authoritarian regimes' influence, how they weaponize their capital, and then leverage the investment in some key industries in young democracies, and as a way to influence their policies. So my question is probably for Nick and maybe for everyone. So I know that some media outlets in Taiwan are also bought or owned by some tycoons who have very significant economic interest in China. Do you think that's a bigger threat than this misinformation, disinformation? Because based on Nick, your presentation, if I heard you correctly, you say that some people actually believe that China has no need to build bots because, you know, these people already believed inside China, they already believe that, you know, Taiwan is part of China or whatever, you know, China's program that is. So then my question is, and then you gave an example is when President Tsai was elected, a lot of people came to Taiwan and attacked her, Facebook or social media outlet. But then people in Taiwan, they basically kind of just laugh at it, right? So what is really the consequence? What's really the impact on democracy in Taiwan? Because Taiwan's democracy, although it's young, but it's quite solid. So, in your opinion, you know, if you have to compare, do you think, you know, social media under attack is a more serious concern compared to maybe, some media outlets are being controlled by people who have different ideologies?
Yeah, thanks for the great question. my heuristic for thinking about this is that I think China has a relatively smart way of going about these things. I think that sharp power is probably a useful concept when thinking about Chinese information warfare. I kind of go back and forth in my head about whether I think it's a useful concept or not, but today I think it's a useful concept. And the reason why is I think that I view these things on a spectrum, basically. So I think that option one, or high up on the list, top priority for if I'm black-hatting this and I'm thinking I'm the CCP, what they seem to do is try to gain influence and kind of wage information warfare through traditional media channels. That seems to be what's been observed. I was recently at a conference where I heard someone who was an expert on the One Belt, One Road initiative talking, and she was talking about known incidents where in Africa, China has basically provided journalistic materials to developing democracies, developing journalistic institutions, saying, hey, just put your name on this, we made this, and just say it's yours. Which is really effective, because if you can't trace it back, you're getting the message out, and it seems legitimate, and it seems like it's coming from an on-the-ground source. And similar things, like China owns a television channel in the Philippines, and this media influence case that I mentioned with Taiwan, I think that's top of the list. I think that China, for all intents and purposes, seems to be waging information warfare in a much smarter, much more sophisticated way than, say, Russia 2 years ago, for various reasons. But basically, I think that if those mediums of influence don't deliver in the way that they want, I think that information warfare online, computational propaganda, is kind of the next resort. I think they're all happening at the same time, but there isn't evidence so far of like really sloppy mainland Chinese attempts to deploy computational propaganda. Whether one's more influential than the other, I think they're all, you know, arrows in the same quiver, basically. That'd be a hard thing to quantify. But yeah, that's kind of my take.
I would just maybe add a point there that, you know, we shouldn't assume that we all consume information in the same way, and that, you know, and that I think more studies need to be done in terms of how the behaviors of, you know, younger generations in terms of how they consume information in Taiwan, elsewhere, and the impact that that would have with regards to different means that, you know, China engages in propaganda and disinformation. And so how impressionable maybe we may be to these type of information based on, you know, what we think we know, you know, it's not necessarily the same type of standards we should apply, and that we should have a better understanding in terms of how people consume information, how impressionable people are, you know, with the type of information they can obtain from these different sources.
Yeah. One really quick addition, too, is I think that it's tempting to think of disinformation solely as, like, a contained problem online, whereas I think it's really part of a larger problem. I recently did a report on state-sponsored trolling where we tried to highlight this at the Digital Intelligence Lab, but basically, if you think about increasing data available on individuals, you can use that data, obviously, to make a targeted, basically high-precision disinformation campaign. So you could use data that you'd gathered online, say through bots, to inform what traditional media approach you'd want to take to target, say, like some demographic within the Taiwanese context. So I think it's useful not to think of these things as separate and unconnected. I think there's multiple ways of kind of going about the problem.
One last.
You made a distinction between Russia and China. Now you're talking about state-sponsored trolling. Is China as...
Is China prone to using trolling techniques like what
earlier? Yeah, I think just to, you know, border on being academic, for the report that we did was specifically about like vitriolic online harassment that was directed through the state. But in terms of like the larger idea of propaganda and trolling, yeah, certainly. I mean, obviously, domestic control of information within the borders of China has always been something that the CCP is interested in. But there was an interesting case of a French journalist within China in December of 2015. Ursula Gauthier is her name. She was covering violence in Xinjiang and basically, you know, question the government's narrative about whether this was domestic terrorism or whether they were using terrorism as basically an expedient for doing what they wanted to do and oppressing a minority. And her visa wasn't renewed, her press credentials weren't renewed, and she was forced out of the country. But before that happened, she was harassed online, both on Facebook, which is not available domestically, interestingly, in simplified Chinese, and on like military forums. So basically people were trying to dox her, reveal where she lived, harass her in various ways. And this is documented, I think. The Initium did a piece on it in Taiwan. There's various places in France that wrote about it. But all that to say, yeah, a lot of the same stuff is going on, but it does have sort of variations in the Chinese and Russian contexts.
One last question, and we're about to close.
Barnaby of the Pluralism Project. Now, this is mostly in response to Nick, and just to address what the gentleman just raised, I think every person who supports Taiwan or is Taiwanese online knows about the presence of the infamous 50 Cent Army. You know, this is an operation conducted by the PLA. They're depicted as a military unit. But my main point is that how do you draw the line, when it comes to, like, saying what is misinformation, what is disinformation, what is a foreign agent, etc., because what I observed, especially in the past 2 or 3 years, is that much of this narrative, this scare drummed up about Russian bots or any other kind of bot from any political aisle has been used to actually crush dissenting opinions. And I understand that disinformation from all different superpower state actors is a very big problem. What can be used to address that an informed population and electorate cannot?
Yeah. I think we've kind of seen this theme in various ways today, but this is obviously both a technological and a social problem, and that's one of my favorite things about COFAX, is it's one of the few solutions I've seen that really combines both the technological aspect and the human aspect. You have human fact checkers, but then you have a good bot that's being used to basically automate pushing out that message, which I just really like that solution. Basically in response to your question, I think that this is obviously a super thorny problem. What's a matter of opinion and what's fact or not is sometimes easy to say and sometimes it's not. One of the useful things about this being a digital phenomenon at this point is I think there are objective metrics that you can find to say that objective of whether or not a message is true or false or a matter of opinion or fact, you can say, well, this is definitely a coordinated campaign. So I think that one of the solutions I'm interested in is making bots transparent on social media platforms. So basically you'll see when a bot is promoting a message or if an account is a bot. And Wikipedia does this. One of my colleagues, Robert Gorwa, wrote a cool article in Quartz about this that I'd encourage you to check out. But basically, detecting when online movements are coordinated and setting thresholds for when that basically breaks the law or breaks terms of service is a good way, I think, of undercutting false amplification and getting at some of the computational techniques behind disinformation. I think there's a human element to this problem that won't go away, right? Like, information and free speech should be allowed to thrive. And I think that's a challenge we're going to face in democracies as well in the next 10 years. But I think that getting at those objective metrics that show that something's coordinated, that's a great way of getting at some of the false amplification behind these campaigns.
Kind of piggyback off of Nick's comments, especially about the human component of it, I think the socialization, co-option, narrative dominance, those are all issues I think you're talking about. And at the end of the day, the concept of free and open should continue to be adhered. that there is, like you said, freedom of choice. There's that we as human beings, we have minds that can think, that we can make our own decisions for our own safety. And it really goes back to being a civil liberties issue. So even when we talk about overseas or Chinese students here in the United States who perhaps are organized by the Chinese consulates that are here, the issue is not to kick these out, but to kick these students out of America, but it's really to provide the civil liberties, to provide the securities that our democracy offers for freedom of speech, and to provide them the security that you're here in the United States and you operate under United States law, and you should not be coerced. That Chinese students should not be coerced, they should not be threatened by their government here in the United States. And I think the problem is that the Chinese people, they have been living underneath an authoritarian government since 1949. And they are socialized in a certain way to be able to live and thrive under that type of tense environment. China File had a really interesting report that came out a few days ago, and the author's name is escaping me, but I highly recommend everyone go read it. But it's about the Han Chinese who were sent out to Xinjiang as part of this like monitoring program where a Han Chinese person will live with a Uyghur family and monitor them. And it's a wonderful article that humanizes the Chinese people and humanizes the way that they view their government's policies and the way that they view the issues of freedoms and what's going on in Xinjiang. And what struck me is that they are socialized to condition themselves that they can't go against the party's rule. They can't say, no, I don't want to go out to Xinjiang to like live with these farmers. I want to stay and work in my government bureaucratic job. But they weren't given that choice. They have to go out there. They have to monitor. They have to do these things. So I think going back to the humanization aspects of it, going back to people should be free from coercion. Governments should be free from coercion. That's the whole concept and purpose of free and open, and that should be continued. And hopefully will augment the issues of narrative dominance, of disinformation that we're talking about today.
And thank you very much, Rachel. And I think that brings us to a close at an excellent point, and that is, while our efforts right now are focused on treating the patient, really trying to deal with the effects of how disinformation and propaganda has on democracy, there's another element of it, which is the disease. And I think the disease really is the lack of freedom, the lack of openness of authoritarian regimes. And that's a much harder problem, of course, to solve. But, like you were saying, Rachel, it's that sort of lack of freedom that sort of creates this insular environment that prevents the type of, that is now increasingly impacting the freedom and rights that internationally we enjoy. But we can save that for a whole set of other discussions. Please join me in thanking our panelists. And a final plug, if you're, not registered already for our event next Friday with Shauna Yang Ryan, a Taiwanese-American novelist, author of The Green Island, you may do so on our website at www.globaltaiwan.org. Thank you all very much.